The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
And sheer ignorance is laying waste to our culture as a whole, and not only our political culture. In 1837, in a speech known as the American Scholar Oration, which became famous around the young nation almost as soon as it was delivered at Harvard, Ralph Waldo Emerson observed that the mind of this country, taught to aim at low objects, eats upon itself. Now, Emerson was issuing a challenge to a young nation still engaged in building up its intellectual capital. But his words resonate much more strongly today in a society that I believe has engaged in dissipating its intellectual capital for decades. All of our current problems, from our involvement in a war based on disregard for evidence to a health care crisis that is the product of fears stirred up by characters on television commercials, remember Harry and Louise, of course you do, can be traced to the intellectual failings of a society that has for too long aimed its mind at low objects. If I were a politician, I would probably be calling you folks right about now. But that's one word you're not going to hear from me tonight. I'd be happy to call you citizens, ladies and gentlemen, or even just human beings, but not folks, the term so beloved of every political candidate trying to prove that he or she is just one of the boys or one of the girls. This word is a plague spread by the President of the United States, pompous television anchors, radio talk show hosts, and anyone else attempting to demonstrate his or her identification with ordinary, presumably wholesome American values. Look up any important presidential speech in the history of the United States before 1980, and you will not find a single patronizing appeal to folks. Imagine, just imagine, we here highly resolve that these folks shall not have died in vain, and that government of the folks, by the folks, and for the folks shall not perish from the earth. In the 1950s, even though there were no orators of Lincoln's eloquence on the political scene, voters still expected their leaders to employ dignified, if not necessarily erudite, speech. Now, Adlai Stevenson may have sounded too much like an intellectual to suit the taste of average Americans, but proper grammar and respectful forms of address were mandatory for anyone seeking high office. Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was much mocked by highbrow intellectuals at the time, was a Demosthenes compared with what we're used to today, which is Bush speak. Now, the gold standard of presidential oratory for adult Americans in the 50s was the memory of Franklin D. Roosevelt, whose patrician accent in no way detracted from his extraordinary ability to make a direct connection with ordinary people. It's impossible to read transcripts of FDR's famous fireside chats and not mourn the passing of a civic culture that appealed to Americans to expand their knowledge and understanding instead of pandering to the lowest common denominator. Roosevelt would no more have addressed his fellow citizens as folks than he would have uttered an obscenity over the radio. At the end of 1940, attempting to prepare his countrymen for the coming of war and to tell them that America must become the arsenal of democracy, the president spoke in characteristic terms to the public, and I'd just like to read a small excerpt. "Tonight, in the presence of a world crisis, my mind goes back 8 years to a night in the midst of a domestic crisis. I well remember that while I sat in my study in the White House, preparing to talk to the people of the United States, I had before my eyes the picture of all of those Americans with whom I was talking. I saw the workmen in the mills, the mines, and the factories, the girl behind the counter, the small shopkeeper, the farmer doing his spring plowing, the widows and the old men wondering about their life savings. These words, their dignity and their respect for the public, really make me want to weep, even though I'm reading them and not hearing them. They ought to make us all want to weep. Substitute folks for people, farmers, old men, and widows, and the relationship between the abandonment of dignified public speech and the degradation of the political process becomes clear. To keep telling Americans that they are just folks is to expect nothing special, a ratification and exaltation of the ordinary that is one of the distinguishing marks of anti-intellectualism in any era. Now, we're not hearing much about America's intellectual problems during this campaign for the obvious reason that candidates are hotly competing for votes from an anti-rational sector of the public, not to mention that some of the candidates themselves offer perfect examples of the dumbing down of American public life. I mean, truly, consider a debate in which candidates are asked to raise their hands if they don't believe in evolution, and three men in business suits actually do raise their hand. I suppose these folks still believe that Tinkerbell doesn't die in Peter Pan because people clap their hands. I began writing my book with the idea of what would in certain respects be a sequel to Richard Hofstadter's classic Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, which was published in early 1963 in that hopeful interval between the McCarthy era and the social convulsions of the late 60s. This period now seems as distant as the Peloponnesian Wars. One of the major virtues of liberal society in the past, Hofstadter wrote, was that it made possible such a variety of styles of intellectual life. One can find men notable for being passionate and rebellious, others for being elegant and sumptuous, or spare and astringent, clever and complex, patient and wise, and some equipped mainly to observe and endure. What matters is the openness and generosity needed to comprehend the varieties of excellence that could be found even in a single, rather parochial society. It is possible, of course, Hofstadter wrote, that the avenues of choice are being closed and that the culture of the future will be dominated by single-minded men and women of one persuasion or another. It is possible, but insofar as the weight of one's will is thrown onto the scales of history, one lives in the belief that it not be so. I was moved by those words as a college student when I read them more than 40 years ago, and I'm still moved by them. During the past four decades, though, America's endemic anti-intellectual tendencies have been grievously exacerbated by a new species of semi-conscious anti-rationalism, feeding on and fed by an ignorant popular culture of video images and unremitting noise that leaves no room for contemplation or logic. This new form of anti-rationalism has, I believe, propelled a surge of anti-intellectualism capable of inflicting vastly greater damage than its historical predecessors inflicted on American culture. Indeed, popular anti-rationalism and anti-intellectualism are now synonymous. I can't call myself a cultural conservative because that term has been hijacked by the religious right and is customarily used to describe a person preoccupied with such matters as the preservation of under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, the promotion of premarital chastity, and let's not forget the protection of cancer patients from marijuana addiction. I do, however, consider myself a cultural conservationist, committed in the strict dictionary sense to the preservation of culture from destructive influences, natural decay, or waste. Now, anti-intellectualism has always been a part of American life, and there was a great deal of logic and historical truth in Hofstadter's view of anti-intellectualism as a rather a cyclical phenomenon that could also be contained and held back by the forces of reason and learning. Hofstadter died in 1970 at age 54. If he had lived into our current age of unreason, like his contemporary Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and written a sequel, I think he would have had to confront a much darker anti-rational reality than one that existed at the end of the 1950s. My premise is that we're being engulfed by a wave of anti-intellectualism coupled with anti-rationalism that differs from traditional American anti-intellectualism not only in degree but in kind. It's tough to talk about this without being seen as a Chicken Little running around saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. But what if the sky really is falling? Each time I've written a magazine article or newspaper column to help promote this book, the editor has always cautioned me in advance, "Don't sound like a snob." And that, unfortunately, is part of the problem. It's the everyday version of the political accusation that one is an elitist, which can mean anything from having gone to an Ivy League university to speaking a foreign language fluently. One example of the difference between the environment in which Hofstadter was writing and today's political and cultural environment is very well illustrated by two presidential visits to France, one by John Kennedy in 1961, the other by George W. Bush in 2002. Kennedy, as those of you who are old enough will recall, wowed both the French and the Americans at home by displaying and using as his interpreter a wife who spoke fluent French. Now, Kennedy himself hardly spoke a word of French, but he saw that as a deficiency, not something to be proud of. Bush, by contrast, seemed to think there was something sinister about any American speaking French. At a joint press conference in 2002 with President Jacques Chirac, for example, Bush responded petulantly when NBC correspondent David Gregory posed a question to Chirac in fluent French. "Very good," snapped the President of the United States. And I quote directly, "The guy memorizes four words, and he plays like he's intercontinental," unquote. An amazed Gregory started to reply, but Bush, who just turned red in the face with anger, cut him off and said, "I'm impressed. Que bueno. I'm literate in two languages myself." The implication that any American who addressed a foreign leader in his own language must be putting on some sort of an act was quite clear. It is unthinkable that any European president would criticize a European correspondent for asking an American president a question in English. Bush might as well have had "ignorant and proud of it" stamped on his forehead. But he is not the cause of America's current cultural plight. And in the past couple of weeks, I've argued with a number of radio talk show hosts who've tried to get me to blame the Bush administration for the decline of American culture. I think the fact that someone with as little regard for intellect as Bush could be considered seriously for the presidential nomination is a symptom of where we are today as a nation culturally, not a cause. And I should also emphasize that anti-intellectualism is a phenomenon that encompasses both the cultural right and the cultural left. I think the main characteristics that distinguish the current wave of American anti-intellectualism from the older forms described by Hofstadter, there are three of them. First is the triumph of the video culture over print, fostered by the mass infotainment media and our growing dependence on passive forms of entertainment. The second anti-intellectual force is the quixotic persistence of religious fundamentalism. And I make no bones about it. Fundamentalism, not religion, but fundamentalism, which depends on the belief that every word in the Bible is literally true, is by definition profoundly anti-rational. Now, fundamentalism, which wasn't called that until the 20th century, has been a part of the American experience since the beginning. But what's different today is the dissonance between fundamentalism and the state of modern knowledge. The U.S. is the only country in the developed world in which a large proportion of the population, about 30%, still believes in the literal truth of sacred books written thousands of years ago. The third element shaping the American intellectual scene today is a very deficient system of public education in which an unprecedented percentage of Americans, are exposed to at least some form of higher education, but much of the public knows less than our grandparents or great-grandparents did when they graduated from eighth grade at the turn of the century. All of these forces have fused anti-intellectualism with anti-rationalism in what I call junk thought. As to the underlying forces, it's not an original observation on my part, but for the first time in the history of man, it's possible to be connected to our video and sound equipment every hour of every day. Now, obviously, it's not only Americans who are exposed to the 24/7 infotainment culture, but there are some elements of our culture. One of them are romance with technology that makes Americans particularly susceptible to these influences. During the past few years, for example, there's been a particularly ominous push to convince parents that children ought to be introduced to video in the cradle, as long as it's educational video, of course. One of the most common statements made on blogs by anxious parents, fearful that too much viewing is bad for their children, is, "We never let our children watch TV, only videos." A comical example of this widespread rationalization is the enthusiasm of ambitious, time-starved parents for the Baby Einstein series, which force-feeds toddlers with a series of educational films designed to introduce them to everything from Monet's water lilies to the poetry of Wordsworth. Infants as young as 6 months are next in line. Home Box Office's classical Baby, which premiered in the spring of 2005, is a perfect illustration. The half-hour video consists of musical excerpts from Tchaikovsky, Bach, Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin, all accompanied by animated images of clowns, fairies, and animals, and really irritating glimpses of famous paintings by Jackson Pollock, Vince Van Gogh, and Claude Monet. Now, when groups opposed to marketing videos to infants objected, Dr. Eugene Barrison, a child psychiatrist on the staff of the Harvard Medical School, and what else, a consultant to HBO, declared that to say this kind of TV is bad is tantamount to saying art is bad. Now, don't mistake me. It's a fine thing for tired parents to gain a quiet hour for themselves by mesmerizing small children with videos. I did it with my nieces when they were young when I got sick of them, and I made no apologies for it. And who would be stuffy enough to suggest that the occasional hour in front of animals dancing to Tchaikovsky can do a baby any real harm? But let's not delude ourselves that education is what's going on. Or rather, education is going on. But it's the kind of education that wires young brains to focus on prepackaged visual stimuli accompanied by a lot of noise. Only today, in the science section of the New York Times, I was reading an article on the train down from New York about the impact of television in the bedroom on children. And it seems that between 50% and 70% of kids under the age of 12, depending on which study you believe, have a television set in their bedrooms. And what this study found, and it's astonishing that anyone needed a study to learn this, is that having a television in the bedroom, first of all, pushed the viewing hours of TV upwards 9 hours for kids, from 21 hours a week to 30 hours, and made them more likely to smoke and less likely to read. Well, I could have told them that. I put a television set out of my bedroom years ago because it made me more likely to eat cookies at night. Now, predictably, the video culture has spawned an electronic cottage industry of scholars and writers taking up the cudgels in defense of the multi-billion-dollar conglomerates and poo-pooing people like me for our reservations about sucking at the video tit from cradle to grave. Only in today's America could a book titled Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter, have received respectful reviews. The author, Stephen Johnson, writes, "Parents can sometimes be appalled at the hypnotic effect that television has on toddlers. They see their otherwise vibrant children gazing silently, mouth agape at the screen, and they assume the worst, that television is turning their child into a zombie. But not to worry," Johnson assures us. "Those glazed stares at television and later at video games, quote, are not signs of mental atrophy. They're signs of focus. But the real point is not what children are focusing on, but what they're screening out with this focus, which is most likely, as you all know, directed a video they've already seen dozens of times." Johnson then goes on to declare that studies demonstrating the decline of reading and writing skills are deeply flawed because they ignore the huge explosion of reading, not to mention writing, that has happened thanks to the rise of the Internet. While conceding that email exchanges or web-based dissections of the television show The Apprentice are not the same as literary novels, Johnson notes approvingly that both are, quote, equally text-driven. One might as well make the statement that kiddie porn and Titian nudes are equally image-driven because they are. And we're an increasingly innumerate as well as a-literate culture. The most recent assessment by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, a Paris-based agency, France again, that conducts regular education evaluations in the world's industrialized nations, found that American 15-year-olds ranked 24th out of 29 countries in mathematical literacy. In science, we're not the worst. We're just 14th among 25th. Now, this is not to suggest that Americans are unique in mathematical and scientific illiteracy, but that there is a unique gap between America's image of itself, the we're number one image, as the world's leader in technology, and the reality of a nation in which more students are spending more years in school while falling behind the developed nations of Europe and Asia. The issue is not just that American students perform poorly in relation to students in other countries on standardized tests, but that large numbers of us do not possess the requisite knowledge for intelligent discussions of public affairs, which require a basic grasp of the laws of probability as well as the realities of history. It's often noted that fewer than half of Americans believe in any form of evolution. This is, again, unique in the industrialized world. And this is often attributed to religious fundamentalism is alone. But consider this. According to surveys conducted for the National Science Foundation over the past 20 years, two-thirds of Americans are unable to identify DNA as the key to heredity. This has nothing to do with religion. One should not have to be an intellectual, or for that matter, a college graduate, to know that DNA is what makes each of us a unique human being. This level of scientific illiteracy provides fertile grounds for political appeals based on sheer ignorance, which I call junk thought. Junk thought is a centrist phenomenon, not an extremist phenomenon. In a stunning example of the mainstreaming of junk thought coupled with junk science, Supreme Court Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy, in a 5-4 opinion that upheld a ban on so-called partial birth abortion last year, cited the, quote, severe depression and loss of esteem, unquote, that may follow an abortion as one rationale for the court's decision. The only problem with this is there's no evidence at all to support the idea that depression is any more common in women who've had abortions than in those who have 10 children. In fact, I would be willing to bet that a lot of women with 10 children are quite depressed a lot of the time. Now, Kennedy even admitted that we have no reliable data to measure this phenomenon of post-abortion traumatic syndrome, which is been entirely invented by anti-choice organizations and based entirely on anecdotal accounts. Of course, some women regret their choice to have an abortion. Some women also suffer from severe postpartum suicidal depression, which, unlike post-abortion syndrome, is a scientifically documented condition. But we don't, therefore, pass laws preventing all women, or even those with a history of postpartum psychosis, from bearing children. Time prevents me from offering more examples of junk thought, but I'll be happy to take questions afterward on this subject. My point is that junk thought is not just silly. It's not just a joke, but dangerous. Anti-rationalism is dangerous, and both are deadly to democracy. What we're not hearing about enough is the responsibility of Americans themselves, not the demon entity known as Washington, which all of these anti-Washington politicians are racing to get to, for the low level of our public discourse. The punditocracy likes to talk about political culture as if it were separate from our culture as a whole, but I don't believe that. I think our political culture is a reflection of our larger culture. Now, real political leadership, comparable to Roosevelt's effort to educate Americans in the late 1930s about their stake in the future of Europe and the threat posed by Nazism, could take advantage of the public anger about the war in Iraq to make this a truly teachable moment instead of a simple repudiation of a failed policy. But it would take awesome courage for a candidate to say to voters, the problem isn't just that you were lied to. The real problem is that we as a people have become too lazy to learn what we need to know to make sound public decisions. And the candidate should include themselves in that. The problem is that two-thirds of us can't find Iraq on a map, and many members of Congress don't know a Shiite from a Sunni. The problem is that most of us don't bother to read newspapers or even watch the news on television. Our own ignorance is our own worst enemy. It's so much easier, so much safer politically to simply say you were the victims of a lie than to suggest that both voters and their elected representatives in both parties must shoulder much of the blame for their willingness to be lied to. It is easy to imagine the chorus of sneers from ignorant talking heads on cable news if a presidential candidate dared to use the word ignorance in public. And by the way, to come full circle to my earlier point about the debasement of language, one of the most disheartening political developments of the past few weeks has been the attack on Barack Obama by Hillary Clinton, suggesting that Obama's ability to make an inspirational speech is somehow opposed to practical solutions. The idea that there is something not to be trusted about a man who talks too good is straight out of a very old anti-intellectual American political playbook. Now, Dwight Eisenhower famously described an intellectual as someone who takes more words than he needs to tell more than he knows. It's particularly ironic that Bill Clinton, who, whatever his faults, was certainly one of the smartest and best educated presidents in recent history, is resorting to this sorry tactic and suggesting that Obama's speaking ability renders him a member of the impractical so-called elites. You go to the Constitution Center and you're reminded that this opposition between thinking and doing was not part of the heritage of the people who founded this country. They didn't see any contradiction between those two things. Now, at the end of every book that's somewhat pessimistic, the editors asked you to please write your recommendations for fixing this, which was a real problem. I don't have a larger one, although I think having more intelligent political leaders could help a bit, and I'll be happy to expand on that in questions. But political leaders aren't the answer. If there's any way to resist the worst aspects of our culture today, to battle against what I call the culture of distraction, it really can only be created one family at a time, by parents and citizens determined to preserve a saving remnant of those who prize memory and true learning above all else. I do stress the role of parents and adults, because it's only in early childhood that parents can, to a considerable extent, control their children's access to poisonous infotainment as well as poisonous food. Adult self-control, not digital parental controls on computers and television sets, is the chief requirement for the transmission of individual and historical memory. A parent who sits down in front of the television after dinner for hours every night, all the while monitoring children's computer use to make sure that their homework is done before they go online, is sending a very mixed message about books, because screen time of whatever sort is the reward for children who've done all of their boring Gutenberg-era chores. Books are the spinach, video infotainment is the dessert. Like all conservationists, a cultural conservationist in today's America can only act in hope while living with amply justified fear. In his American Scholar oration, Emerson asked, "What is the remedy? Is it not the chief disgrace in the world not to be a unit, not to be reckoned one character, not to yield that particular fruit which each man was created to bear, but to be reckoned in the gross, in the hundred, or the thousands? Not so, brothers and friends. Please, God, let it not be so with us." Thank you.
Okay.
Is that working?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
And do you think this began with the rise of television, and then talk radio, I guess, keeps it going quite strongly?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Hofstadter has almost nothing to say about television in his book, even though it's been around for 15 years. But that's because television in the 50s, even though it was popular, it didn't dominate us the way the total electronic media do today. Those of you who are old enough will remember the flag used to come on at night at midnight and all television was off. Also, there were only three networks. That was it. So, you know, it just wasn't as much. And I think, by the way, that it's an error. A lot of consumer groups talking about television and videos and computer programs and so on talk about content as though that were the only issue, as though if only we had all PBS or all great movies or all highly intellectual things on computer screens, that we'd be fine. I think that the amount of time we spend on these things actually matters a great deal more than the content. Oh, yes, certainly it's better to be watching animals dancing to Tchaikovsky than people having their heads chopped off. But really, I think the amount of time is more important than anything else. And I'll tell you why. A couple of years ago, like many people, I tell myself I don't watch much television. And the reason I tell myself that or told myself that is because I was also always reading a book while I was watching television or a video. A couple of years ago, I participated in the annual TV turnoff week. I made it a video turnoff, DVDs, all of those things. I was quite shocked at how hard it was for me for the first few days. I really felt I missed my video friends. And then as the week wore on, I began to realize something else, how much I had been missing from the books I was reading while the images flickered in the periphery of my vision. So I certainly still do watch television and videos, but I watch less of them because I think that when I say the culture of distraction, I mean that when you're multitasking, which is really what reading and watching a video at the same time are, you're not getting the full impact of either of them.
Another question in front here.
Since you've, as I believe you've dated the beginning of the anti-industrial revolution back about 40 years, anti-intellectual revolution or evolution back about 40 years, what, if any, part did the counterculture and the drug culture, if any, in your view, play in that?
I'm going to repeat this because I had a little difficulty hearing this question. My book is about deals with the last 40 years because I wanted to pick up where Hofstadter left out. But his question was, what part, if any, do I believe that the more extreme things like the drug culture of the late 60s and early 70s played in this? I do have two whole chapters on the 60s. And I have very mixed feelings about the 60s, although I am a child of the 60s. You know, I love, my eyes get misty when I hear Paul McCartney, you know, partly because I never could have imagined back then that I ever would be anywhere near the age of 64. But there were, I think, and I was a reporter for the Washington Post in the late 60s. I covered a lot of the campus uprisings of various kinds. And I think that there are two particularly bad heritages from the 60s. One is the culture of celebrity, which I think really began to make itself felt as the video culture imposed itself, and we in the media helped impose it as well. I think that that is one of our most long-lasting heritages of the 60s. It was, as Jerry Rubin, you know, famously said, nobody knows what I'm famous for in the 70s. They just know I was famous. I do think that the drug culture played some role in this, in that the drug culture was extremely anti-intellectual. People like Timothy Leary, who were not as influential as some of the media made them, but nevertheless, the message was, is by blowing your brains out with drugs, you could expand your awareness. And I do think that that idea, the idea that feeling and sensation are everything and rational analysis is nothing, was another negative heritage of that time. But more than that, and I'm giving a rather long answer to your question, I think also in terms of our culture, the settlement that happened after the campus uprisings, it didn't really happen until the early 1970s. There were a lot of legitimate points the students had to make. The whole neglect of black history, of women's history, and various other things that are now known as multicultural studies. But the way university faculties solved it was a bad one, and both the left and the right should be indicted for it, in my view. What they did was they created new departments of women's studies, of black studies, later on of queer studies, as they're called by some people, gay studies, and various forms of multicultural studies. I think that this had two effects. One, it pushed a lot of these things which should have been integrated into the common core of the college curriculum, it pushed them into a multicultural studies ghetto. So that those who taught culture, as if women writers didn't exist, as if blacks didn't exist, could go on teaching in the same way. And students and professors who were interested in the other thing were ghettoized, in effect. Now, some universities now have done a better job than others at integrating these studies into the larger curriculum. But it is still possible. When I graduated from Michigan State in 1965, I graduated from Michigan State, and I was in an honors program sort of specializing in history in a way. I hadn't read a word of W.E.B. Du Bois. I hadn't read a word of Langston Hughes. It is still possible today for an English major or a history major or a business major to graduate from a university and not read a word of those writers, unless they take a special African-American studies course. I think that this settlement on college campuses is hurting higher education to this day. And I say this not because I think that things like African-American studies and women's studies and all of these things don't belong in the common curriculum, but because they do. Where they don't belong is in a ghetto where large numbers of students aren't exposed to them at all.
Another question in, right in front here. Sir, gentleman in front of you, we'll get to you next.
When I was in grade school, we had geography. We all knew from maps where countries throughout the world were located. Now we read about how such large majorities of high school and even college students in America can't find the U.S. on a map of the world. I'm wondering when geography, if you can estimate a particular year or time, geography was eliminated from the curriculum.
I'm glad you asked that question, because I think while I was talking about colleges, I think the essential problems begin in elementary and secondary school, not in college. I think they're things that every high school graduate ought to know. Geography is barely taught as a separate subject anymore. It's considered part of cultural studies. And the result was, in 2006, National Geographic Roper did a poll of Americans from 18 to 25. And that was where the two-thirds can't find a rock on a map came out of. And by the way, this is a map with the names of the countries written in. So it's not a blank map. What it means is they don't know what part of the map to look for these countries on. But here was the worst thing in this. They said, but there's good news. 23% of students with some college education can find Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Israel on a map. But what does that mean? That's good news? That means three-quarters of kids who've had some college can't find those countries, all of which are vital to American interests, on a map. But more important, I think, is the fact that the study also found that the majority didn't think it was important to know the location of other countries in which news was being made. And 44% didn't think it at all important to know a public language, a foreign language. And that, here, not knowing is ignorance, but thinking it's not all important is anti-rational. It is ignorant and proud of it.
Time for more questions. Gentleman in the fourth row here.
Thank you. I'm more interested in this subject when you talked about the fundamentalism. And I know your point is that the future is with children. Sam Harris, Christopher Chitchens, Richard Dawkins, in addition to your book in 2004, have certainly been, in the last 4 years, added a whole lot of other counterthought to what has essentially been your fundamentalist point. And I don't know about you, but I was amazed at this Pew survey, 16% no religious affiliation, and 44% that change religions like it's, you know, a napkin. My point is, now this is a counterpoint to something what you may have done with the book. Do you think this is it's going to move forward? I mean, this profusion over the last 4 years, is this an indicator of a pendulum shift that you think at this point for the future, or is this the high water mark?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is Actually, also, the 30% of people who believe in the literal truth of the Bible is down 10 points from 1980, too. A lot of these things are not publicized. I don't know whether, for instance, the fact that only half as many people are affiliated with any church, it certainly means that traditional Orthodox religion is weaker, but I'm not sure that it means that anything more rational has filled the vacuum. I just don't know. One of the problems with this is that that Americans also, ironically, since we're the most religious country in the developed world, also don't know very much about religion. Stephen Prothero, who's a professor of religious studies at Boston College, wrote a book called Religious Literacy last year. And some of the polls he cited, in which in this God-fearing, God-believing country, more than half of Americans don't know that Genesis is the first book of the Bible. They can't name the four Gospels. Now, again, this shows, and by the way, I think that's one of the reasons why fundamentalists push so hard for more religion in schools and so on, is I think they want the schools to do the job which traditionally homes and churches did. But one of the things that I concluded from this is that the vast majority of Americans think that both creationism and evolution should be taught in the schools. My guess is, from reading these polls about how little Americans actually know about religion, that probably a lot of these people don't really know what either creationism or evolution is. So to answer your question, I don't know what this religious shift means, I would like to see fewer fundamentalists. I have a somewhat different view of this subject than Sam Harris, who's a friend of mine, and Richard Dawkins do. They have argued that moderate religion is just as bad as fundamentalism because it's a stalking horse for fundamentalism. I don't agree with that. Frankly, I don't think that we would have any problem with separation of church and state if the whole country was composed of Unitarians and liberal Catholics and Reformed Jews. And also, I don't agree, although I'm speaking about rationality. Part of rationality is recognizing that our brains are probably wired to hold two conflicting ideas at the same time, which is why there are many people of moderate religion who also believe in God. Just as there are people who can look at our divorce rate and think, maybe my marriage won't last, but at the same time also believe in true and everlasting love. I suspect that our brains are hardwired to hold two conflicting ideas at the same time, but I could really be wrong about that.
Another question. I'm going back on my right here, about six rows back. 10, actually, in the red. Yeah, could you keep your hand up?
One thing I wonder with your argument here, I agree that we're anti-intellectual now. I'm just maybe a little bit cynical that we were so much better in the past. You bring up the 23% of college-educated Americans can identify, Iraq, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. I'm thinking back to 20, 25 years ago when I was in that age range and hearing that some depressingly low percentage of my contemporaries could place World War II, the Civil War, the American Revolution in the correct century, let alone the correct decade. And then going back further, H.L. Mencken's quote, and I'm paraphrasing here, no one ever went broke underestimating the American public.
Intelligence of the American public.
I'm a techie, sorry. But it's also when you look at, we can see what everyone is doing now in part because of this video culture. If you go back 50 or 100 or 200 years, you've got that winnowing of, not as many people were literate. The people who were literate who could read could not necessarily write. Whether or not what they wrote lasted. Was it that great in the past? I mean, I think we've been stupid forever.
No, and if you read my book, you'll find that I don't make the case that there was a golden age in the past. But, by the way, you talked about 25 or 30 years ago, and about 35 years ago is when things like geography and chronology and history started to be eliminated from schools. We don't know We can't exactly compare what people knew in the past with today, because a lot of the questions that are being asked today weren't in the past. What we do know is that the general level of knowledge in math and science, in history, in American history, has gone down enormously during the last 20 years, because pollsters have been asking the same questions since about 1980. So no, I'm not saying that there was a golden age. I think two things. I think the aspirations of what was known as middle-brow culture were higher. I think that people expected, it was part of the American dream, that their children would know more than they would. I don't think that people necessarily have that expectation today, and they shouldn't have it. Although a lot of people say, oh, the kids are so much smarter than we are because they can use computers. Wrong. Computers are great, and I should say right now, I'm not a Luddite, and it's now worse to be called a Luddite than to be called a slut in American culture, believe me. It's the worst thing you can say about someone. But I think that when someone says, oh, the children are so smart they can use computers, well, if there had been computers when my grandmother was in eighth grade, she would have been able to use a computer too. Smartness and the ability to use new tools aren't the same thing. And I think one of the ways we're going wrong in terms of technology is in thinking of it as this sort of godlike, transformative thing, rather than as a tool. In other words, the Internet is a wonderful tool. But, for instance, those who claim that it's resulted in an explosion of reading, I believe are wrong, because I think that there are exceptions, but what most of us do on the Internet, I think, and it's great. I'm happy I don't have to look through 10 books to find out a date when I'm writing a book, that I can just type in that date on the Internet, and a nice page comes up and tells me all the great things that happened in that year in the world. But without being connected to a larger edifice of knowledge, this information means very little. And also, the idea that what people are doing on computers and what kids are doing on computers, the study in the Times today didn't talk about computers in the bedroom, which I also think is a bad idea, because you know very well that people are not reading great books on computers. What most kids are doing is they're checking out and obsessing about various profiles on MySpace, watching the latest person throwing up or making a fool of themselves on YouTube. So, again, you're also talking about time spent looking at a screen. But no, I don't think that there was a golden age in the past, but I do think there was the age in which people aspired to more and were less content with passivity.
Let's keep moving back. The lady in the red here. If you could wait for the mic, please.
This is really more of a comment than a question, but you know, you use the word aspiration, and I think that's something that's missing. But I moved to California in the 80s, and I developed this feeling that, or this impression that it wasn't, what did you learn in school today, but how do you feel about what happened today, and how do we, and I think that's happened now everywhere, and is it possible to change that attitude?
I don't know. You know, that's part of really what I call junk thought. And now I'm going to give you another example of junk thought, which addresses itself actually to this feeling question. You may be aware that there is a huge movement for sex-segregated education now. Many people want to spend public money on separate classrooms for boys and girls. There are other best-selling books advocating this entire theory. And it's all based on this, that girls and boys learn in such different ways that it's better to teach them in separate classes. Boys, and there are a lot of people making money, by the way, now consulting public schools on this, that boys are more wired, they're more energetic, they don't like to sit still and be quiet and read as much as girls. So boys should be taught in classrooms where they're allowed to jump around more and, you know, just move around more and have more recess. Girls, on the other hand, because they like to talk more than boys, should be taught in separate classrooms and allowed to talk to each other in class more, because girls' learning styles are based on emotional relationships with others. Well, this is utter junk thought. And I'm not saying, by the way, that there are not some differences between the way the brains of men and women are wired, but whatever they are, and whatever role culture plays and biology plays, they are, these differences are so insignificant compared with what we have in common as members of the same species. It is exactly, and what is really terrible about this is this entire sex-segregated school movement is based on the worst myths of the past, anti-rationalist myths of the past. We have heard it all before. We heard that slaves were not capable of learning to read, but just in case, southern states passed laws against teaching slaves to read. We heard that women were biologically unfit for higher education in the 19th century. This is only more of the same thing. And it is junk thought, and it's also based on the idea that people ought to be educated on the way they feel, regardless of whether it's true, whether they feel that way or not. What's really fascinating to me is some of my fellow feminists support this, too. And there's been much written about how boys aren't as verbal as girls. Well, some feminists have argued that girls in elementary school need to be in sex-segregated classrooms because boys are too verbally aggressive. So which is it? What I ask you is, what is going to happen to these boys and girls educated in separate classes when the boys have to go into an office where they have to sit down at a desk? They're not allowed to run around the room while they work. And when the girls go into an office in which they're not allowed to text message each other all day and talk to each other today, in which they too have to function in a formal desk setting.
Folks, we have time for a couple more questions. Gentleman in the middle here with his hand up. We'll get you a mic.
You indicate that your study basically covers the last 40 years. And it would seem that if you really believe that there's been this degradation in enlightened thought, rationality, logical thinking, that there should be some consequence of that. In other words, we should have observed our standard and quality of living deteriorating at the same time we see the reduction in these other attributes. And one would presume that your hypothesis is that this is going to continue, and we should see even a further degradation of our standard and quality of living. Do you believe that this has occurred, and do you believe that it will get worse?
You know, I really think that we have been living for a long time on inherited capital. In other words, the American economy at mid-century, let us say, you know, the period at the end of World War II, was so powerful. It was such a great engine that I think that we were able to exist for a long time without seeing a diminution. And moreover, the 60s and 70s and early 80s, the adults running the country were the beneficiaries of one of the greatest things that ever expanded opportunity in American society, which was the GI Bill after World War II. But I think that what has happened now is that assumption of an upward movement, we certainly see from what has happened in American manufacturing, from advances in science and technology that are proceeding elsewhere, because such as in stem cell research, we certainly see that America cannot certainly feel itself to be number one in the world in science and technology in a way that I think Americans could justly think of themselves, even with Sputnik, in 1960. Also, I think inevitably we are going to see a degeneration in all kinds of standards of living if this educational problem is not addressed. I really do. I hope that we can have. All I want to do in this book was start a conversation about this. And the other night after the Wisconsin primary, last week now, another generation ago, I heard Barack Obama talking about education. And what he was saying this is not going to be an easy problem to address, but it can't just be addressed by government programs, that parents are going to have to turn off the TV more. They're going to have to put away the video games more. They're going to have to talk to their children more and read to their children more. Now, obviously, just individual responsibility, I mean, in a way, that's a cop-out. And I don't pretend to have solutions. But I certainly do not feel that life in the United States is economically better for most people than it was 20 years ago. I think, for example, our broken health care system is partly a result of our not knowing how these things might be done in the rest of the world and how they might be adapted, our listening to commercials with Harry and Louise instead of any educational effort to think about what's wrong and how to fix it. I do think the state, the level of public knowledge, certainly has to affect every aspect of the way we live.
People, unfortunately, we are out of time. Please join me in saying merci to Susan Jacoby.
Thank you. I probably had better go back in that room and get my stuff.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.